The year was 1985. Ronald Reagan was sworn in for his second term in office. We Are the World topped the charts. And here in the Bay Area, Stanford history professor Claiborne Carson got a call from Mrs. Coretta Scott King.
When she called me in 1985, it was out of the blue.
But hearing from the widow of Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't necessarily a complete surprise. Carson had written a book about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the dynamic grassroots organization behind much of the civil rights movement. But the call from King that fateful day would change Carson's life forever.
I was not even expecting a call, and particularly expecting a call offering me this position of directing this effort to publish all the papers of Martin Luther King.
Coretta Scott King wanted Carson to tell her husband's life story through his papers, hundreds of thousands of documents that she possessed. Carson was flattered, but hesitant. His research focus was on the grassroots, not leadership.
In fact, much of my work was in response to the historians who were kind of attributing so much to King that as if the movement would not have occurred if King had never been born.
So Carson was conflicted for a bit.
I remember recommending other people who might be better than I was. But then after I got off the phone, I remember my wife said, do you want to spend the rest of your career saying, you know, that you could have been editor of Martin Luther King's papers and you turned it down?
He didn't. In fact, Carson would spend the rest of his professional life dedicated to Dr. King's. Over the next 28 years, he became immersed in King's writings. He published the King Papers Project, 6 volumes of speeches, sermons, correspondence, publications, and unpublished writings. In 2005, he founded the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. And now he has a new memoir out entitled Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Claiborne Carson joined me in studio to talk about the legacy of Dr. King as he would have wanted it to be. I asked him first if anything surprised him as he was going through King's papers.
Oh, of course I was surprised. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, Martin's Dream. Part of what I was trying to do with that book, it's a memoir that's just been published, and it was an effort to say, you know, over the last 50 years, I've learned a lot, and I've never had really an opportunity to talk about some of the less known aspects of King that I've learned that still, you know, there are documents that I've seen that no other scholar has seen. You know, the love letters that Martin wrote to Coretta when they were courting in the early 1950s, when he talks about his socialistic attitudes, and she's similarly remarkably radical for that time. This is in the middle of the McCarthy era, and you have these two young black people writing love letters to each other, but also talking politics and talking about, the need for socialism in the United States. I mean, I can see why she kept these letters very private until the end of her life. If some of these letters had come out when King was emerging as a leader, he would have been, you know, many people believed he was a communist, and they didn't make a distinction between his socialistic attitudes and communism. So I think it would have destroyed his career if the letters had been revealed. So I kind of understood why she kept them in a box under her bed until the 1990s. But now I think it's time for people to see materials like that. And part of what I've been trying to do quite recently is talk about what was going through King's head as he was delivering the I Have a Dream speech. Many Americans don't realize that he did not intend to give a speech about his dream.
That's what I wanted to get to next, is most people associate Dr. King with the I Have a Dream speech. And, you know, whenever Martin Luther King Day comes around, you see, you know, the radio and television is filled with the I Have a Dream speech, and children say it in schools. And so that kind of became his signature, and you're now saying that that was not the case.
He worked all night trying to do that speech. He only finished, he said, at 4 a.m. in the morning to write the speech. And the speech he wrote was about the promissory note, about he was saying, he was really directing it at Jefferson, saying, you wrote these wonderful words of the Declaration of Independence. Now it's about time, after the nation has justified its existence on the basis of these ideals, the nation has a responsibility to live up to these ideals.
But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land.
So that was the theme of what his advanced text.
How did the focus become on I Have a Dream throughout
years? Well, he talks about that. He said, you know, I was looking out at the audience, and I was thrilled by the positive response of that audience. And Clarence Jones, who's now working with me at the King Institute at Stanford, who helped him write the speech, the original speech, says that he remembered Mahalia Jackson. Mahalia Jackson, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Shouted out, tell them about your dream, Martin. And whatever, you know, I've heard some other people claim that they were the ones who told him that. But in any case, King then remembered the speech he had given in Detroit a few months earlier, in which he had talked about the dream. And in that moment of inspiration, he began to talk about his dream. And it was all extemporaneous.
Off the cuff.
Yes, you watch him. We had a video at this event, and you can see that he turns his text aside and he doesn't ever look down again. It's all, his focus is on the audience. And he then gave the most famous extemporaneous remarks, I think, in history.
Do you think it is justifiably the most famous group of words said by Martin Luther King?
Yes, I do, because I think that it was extemporaneous, but it was also a speech that he had been planning to give all of his life. He had been talking about, since the 1950s, about the American dream. And, of course, we all talk about what is the American dream. And by turning it into, I have a dream. And he begins to do that in the early 1960s. By 1962, he's talking not about the American dream.
The house with the white picket fence and
the car
and the good job.
Yeah, because the American dream sometimes gets distorted into materialism and all of these sorts of things. But as he talked about his American dream, it was to live up to those ideals that many of us profess, both religious ideals, political ideals, what we think at our better moments, and basically saying we need to live up to that. And I think that provides the inspiration that people draw from that speech. Because when we listen to it, I think it forces us to say, what are our dreams at our best? Are we living up? Are we truly dedicating ourselves to achieving those ideals? And I think that that's what one of the reasons why 50 years later we still remember that speech.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yes. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're talking with Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University, the publisher of Dr. King's papers. He has a new memoir out called Martin's Dream, My Journey in the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. I asked Professor Carson about other speeches Dr. King delivered that he wished had gotten the same attention as I Have a Dream.
Well, certainly his speeches about the war in Vietnam. I think that when you go back to his speech that he gave at Riverside Church and see that he was not just talking about the Vietnam War. He was talking about the possibility that if we didn't learn the lesson of the Vietnam War, we would be fighting those similar wars. And here we are today, still involved in a war in Afghanistan and still trying to extricate ourselves from the war in Iraq. So I think we need to listen to that. If that speech were played as often as the I Have a Dream speech, I think this nation would be a better nation.
Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken.
Also, I think the issue of poverty. You know, I see King not primarily as a civil rights leader. Before he was a civil rights leader, he was a minister of the social gospel. And if you go back and look at the sermons and his private writings from the late 40s, early 50s, you see a person. He writes this one paper when he's at Crozier Theological Seminary, his first year, so he's still a teenager. And he's saying, what is going to be my mission as a minister? And he says, to deal with unemployment, slums, economic insecurity. He doesn't even mention civil rights. So that...
Yet he's known as a civil rights leader.
And yet he's known as a civil rights leader. I like to think that Rosa Parks turned him into a civil rights leader. And he had 10 years from 1955 to 1965 when he did... I think most of us would say a pretty good job as a civil rights leader.
And then after 65.
But after the Voting Rights Act was passed, and that's the last major piece of civil rights legislation, if he had simply been a civil rights leader, he would have retired. He would have gone off and said, you know, look, how many people can bring an end to a system of oppression like the Jim Crow system in the South? I should get a long vacation. Instead, he goes to Chicago and lives in a ghetto. And instead, he goes to Memphis. Instead, he launches the Poor People's Campaign, which I view as the major Occupy movement. I mean, as radical as some of the people were in the Occupy movement of our time, none of them proposed, let's go to the Washington Mall and set up an encampment and let's stay there until our demands are met. You know, that was something that Martin Luther King did. So when we think back, that very few people today would conceive of something quite as radical as that. It kind of gives you a measure of who he really was.
Had you met him?
No, I was at the March on Washington,
and you were 19.
I was 19 years old, and it was certainly the biggest event in my life. It was the most exciting thing I'd ever done. You know, it was the first demonstration I'd ever been in. So
did it impress you at all? Or were you like, this is too long? These are too many people?
No, it very much impressed me. Unfortunately, it kind of spoiled me because I thought, oh, well, this is what civil rights demonstrations are like. And, of course, I would never see anything like that again. And the first person I met right before the March on Washington, just a couple of days before the march, was Stokely Carmichael. And I thought he was typical of Southern civil rights leaders, not workers, not leaders. And a few months later, I met Bob Moses, and I thought, well, gosh, you know, if everybody is like Stokely Carmichael and Bob Moses in this movement, I want to be part of this movement. Now, I didn't know at that time that these two people were very, very exceptional, extraordinary individuals. But it was easy for me to be totally impressed. And actually, one of the things I point out in the book is growing up in a predominantly white small town in New Mexico, where we were one of three families. My basic role models for what it meant to be a young black man were people in the movement, people I read about in the newspapers. I wanted to be like them. And so that had a tremendous impact on my life.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. I'm talking to Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University, publisher of Dr. King's papers, and author of Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. I asked Professor Carson what he thinks is most misunderstood about Dr. King.
I think in terms of putting him on a pedestal,
He didn't want that.
No, he did not want that. I think he saw himself as a flawed, fallible human being, very modest about his own contribution to the movement. He said many times what I've said and creates controversy, and that is that the movement would have happened even if he had never lived. You know, Rosa Parks wasn't waiting for a phone call from Martin Luther King.
So then what do you think he would have felt or thought about Martin Luther King Day, a national holiday?
I think it'd be somewhat uneasy, but you've got to remember that there would not be a King holiday if King had lived, because we would have had to deal with the real King, of the person who was fighting against poverty and, as I said, organizing a mass campaign on the National Mall, a person who was opposed to American intervention in other countries. You know, we would have had to deal with the reality of King. In retrospect, we go back and we create these mythological figures who never existed, and in order to meet our current need for something that's comforting and reassuring, but the real person is upsetting and unsettling. We don't like our saints, to be actually walking around, because we realize they're not saints. They're prophets, which are a different thing. You know, the biblical prophets were not popular in their own time. Their job was to go around and irritate those in charge. Their job was to irritate.
They were not celebrated, that's for sure.
They were not celebrated. Only in retrospect.
If he were here today, what would trouble him the most, do you think?
The lack of attention to the problem of poverty. I think when we have an entire presidential campaign in which you can count on one hand the times that poverty ever came up in any of the presidential debates, that's troubling to me. I can understand why people running for president want to talk about the middle class, because so many Americans, that is the American dream in some ways, that the material part of the American dream is to get to be middle class. But we need to also talk about those who not only are not middle class, but have very little opportunity to get to middle-class status. You know, one of the things I like to do is almost a provocation. I like to just talk about, we were peasants. The greatest movement, the greatest freedom movement in human history was transforming peasants, people who were landless, illiterate, without any rights at all, into citizens of the country where they happened to live. That was a major historical accomplishment. My mother could be defined as a peasant when she grew up in rural Florida under the segregation. And, you know, within her lifetime, she saw her life transformed into, you know, she had a measure of middle-class life. She owned a house. She met my dad at a military base in Alabama, and they created, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, Martin's Dream, is that their notion of the dream was that kind of materialistic of getting us to a place like Los Alamos, New Mexico, where I didn't have to worry about going to a segregated school, where we could live in a 3-bedroom house with a yard. That for many people, even today,
unattainable.
That process of turning peasants into citizens, you know, that's what I think about in terms of immigration policy, is that we still have people making that transition. And unfortunately, in terms of making that transition that my mother made, they cross a national border. And rather than gaining rights, like my mother did by moving north, they lose rights. And so we still need to focus on that kind of issue.
So he would be quite disappointed.
I think that's why he would not be a candidate to have a national holiday named after him.
And so the other question would be, what would he find most promising in today's American society, other than President Obama being elected?
Well, I think that he is one who would definitely keep the focus on both what we have not achieved, but also celebrate what we have achieved. I think people make the mistake both ways. I think that generation, people who were alive during the 2 decades after World War II, who were engaged in those struggles to eliminate the Jim Crow system in the United States, to eliminate colonialism abroad, to eliminate apartheid in South Africa. How many generations can say, during my lifetime, 3 systems of oppression were overcome, so that now I have to tell my students, if you want to learn about the Jim Crow system, pick up a history book. If you want to learn about colonialism, pick up a history book, or apartheid, pick up a history book. He would understand that
progress. That's progress.
That's not only progress, but it's unique in human history. You know, if you really are a progressive, you really feel committed to social justice, imagine that during your lifetime, some kind of oppression that has existed since history began comes to an end, and you help bring about that end. That's something you should always celebrate.